It's shiny
right, this is Pure Decking for August 30th, 1963. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Analog, Big Brother, BSV, and Suave. What is everyone drinking tonight?
Rum.
Bald awesome. Beer.
Doctor's orders, water.
Oh, that's never fun. That's never fun. So, yeah, I didn't get to work on the back end for the station at all. Work is hell for the next month, so I'll work on it when I can. But I just haven't been able to sit down and really hammer out some of the scripting that needs to happen on the back end for the servers. So yeah, when I get to it, I'll get to it. So also wanted to say thanks to Laser for providing a metric crap ton, and that is a technical term, of old server gear. And if you've had to lift any of this stuff, you would realize I'm not kidding about the ton part for the lab and for Digital Dojo. So here, like I said, work's going to be crazy for the next month. So hopefully I'll get to work on some of this stuff between now and then, and I will be able to start doing Digital Dojo in video. So we can actually run through some tools, run some scenarios, have you guys remote in and run capture the flags or whatever. So root the box king of the hill, or just, nice. You know, have you SSH into a Solaris box and see how long it takes for you to just say, you know, kill yourself.
So. 3.5 seconds is my record.
Wait a minute. I don't think you're supposed to have a record.
Really bad at computers.
I don't think you understand the concept.
You also seem to be bad at killing yourself if you have a record and are still alive.
The ambulance just keeps showing up. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I mean, hell. That's actually wrong. I'm just going to scoot right past that into our discussion, because that's just not... Anyways, yeah, I've got a bunch of old server gear. Some of this stuff... Actually, yeah, I'm going to mention it. Some of this stuff, like this, the Sun server I've been goofing around with, I made the mistake of looking up how much the thing actually weighs according to the specifications. It's 65 kilograms. And because I'm American, I didn't really think anything of it, saying, you know, 65, okay, fine, whatever. No, that's 130 pounds. With no nice. Real good handles.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
Morphs needs to hit the bench.
Yeah, actually I do. That's well, I'm moving the thing around all right. It's just kind of like, you know, when you get done, you're like, well, my back hurts. So, but yeah, you're probably right. I probably do need to, if I'm going to be moving these things around any much, I probably need to bulk up a little bit. So, actually, if I just go moving these things around, I probably will bulk up. It's like,
they're doing some deadlifts with them.
Yeah, well, I've done a few already. So, yeah, when you see a computer geek that, you know, looks like they work out, no, that just means that they handle server gear. So, yeah, I some of this stuff, man, I tell you what, it's a mess, because a lot of it's just parts. So I've got my work cut out for me in getting this stuff. And there's a couple of really nice servers, so there's some gems in this stuff. But I've actually got an old Sun Microsystems rack in the garage right now from this. So I don't know if you guys are even into server hardware or not, but I mean, that's like funny as hell to have something like that, because it still actually says Sun on it. So
it's classic.
I like it. I'm gonna end up painting it, but just because it's pretty scruffed up on one side, so I'll just get out the old spray paint and see what I can make it look like. Anyway, so moving right on to our discussion here. This is actually bouncing a little bit off of Shoot the Noise, you know, Big Brother show there, where we started talking about TPP. So just kind of in more general terms, just how much, you know, how much privacy do you really expect to have on the internet? We've got things like SOPA and PIPA and TPP and there was the other one. IP Protect or something like that. And they're all kind of hitting that same thing. And it seems like, you know, every time they bring this up, it gets shot down by the public. I mean, it's not really lawmakers on either side that are shooting this thing down. It's massive protests that are shooting down these kind of things. And they just keep coming back with them, trying to be more and more secretive every time. So it's like they're just going to keep doing it till they get what they want. So I don't know. It seems like the basic premise of all of these laws is that the internet could, maybe, might be used to commit crimes. Obviously, copyright infringement is the big one. And since they can't police it effectively, you know, with all the domain name seizing they've been doing and, you know, cease and desist letters and all the other stuff. But apparently they can't police it effectively, or at least they feel so, since they're trying to pass these laws. So they're trying to turn it into a fully monitored, you know, we can see what you're doing. I'd almost call it a police state style system where it's like, you know, oh, well, you might use this to commit a crime, so we're going to watch every move you do with it.
Yeah, don't really want to live the day that you get arrested for accidentally Googling the wrong word.
Well, that's, you know, is that a possibility?
I think it is.
Well, I expect to get as much privacy out of the internet as I put into it. If I go on Facebook and put all my public data in, it shouldn't be that private for me. However, if I take my time and I make sure that I don't give out my real name, my real address, that I do the right things, I should expect some privacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just to kind of jump ahead a little bit here, I mean, if you think about it, what goes on the web for the most part is in clear text. It's all in public. I mean, unless you see the little lock in HTTPS, or you're using something you know is secured, like Skype VoIP is still encrypted, although they can man in the middle of that now, and SSL, SSH, you know, stuff where you know encryption is being used. It's in clear text. Somebody watching the wire could just, you know, see all of it. Mm-hmm. I guess it comes down to, do you care if the FBI knows what kind of porn you look at?
That's not really my concern. Yes, most of the internet is in clear text. However, I do not like the idea of them setting up different regulatory bodies just so they can measure and analyze every bit of internet traffic. That's ridiculous. Borderline obsessive.
Well, it's massive waste of money on the side job, too, there. But not like our government's ever been concerned about that. But, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but, I mean, I've never really assumed that anything I posted online was going to be a secret. It's like, you know, you have people who post shit on Facebook. It's like you were talking about being real careful about it. Well, you have people who don't care. They've got their phone set to automatically upload everything they do to Facebook. And it's like, well, I set it to private. You know, it doesn't matter if Facebook sets everything to be public, like every couple of months when they change their privacy policies again. They default it all back to public every couple of months. People don't seem to realize that. It's like, oh, well, no, I set it to private, friends only. So.
Yeah.
And then you got people, you know, you got employers wanting your freaking passwords to your Facebook account so they can make sure that, I don't know, you don't have any fun. I mean,
that's just ridiculous. Besides, wasn't that shot down by one of the courts here in America?
Yeah, no, they...
Yeah, well, basically, they're not allowed to, like, not hire you because you wouldn't give them the password. But really, when it comes down to it, if they have a job opening and five people apply and one of those people says, no, I won't give you my password, guess who they're going to hire?
Somebody else. Well, you know, something else that got me thinking about this... you know, of course, we got an election going on in the states here. And actually, both the Democrats and the Republicans have you know, a something they call internet freedom as part of their platforms. Now, the Republicans, you know, theirs is the most recent one to come out. They're essentially saying we don't want we don't want to regulate the net. We want to stay away from regulating the net. And essentially they're telling the FCC to get bent. Then you have the Democrat side, which is more, well, we want to do net neutrality. We want to use some of these government agencies to enforce these rules. So I guess the way I kind of read it was the Republicans are more business friendly, as in telling companies, no, you can manage your network however you want. We're not going to get in your business. And the Democrats are probably a little bit more consumer friendly, where it's like, well, no, we're going to put these rules in about privacy and internet, you know, net neutrality. And I don't know. I kind of side on, I'd rather not see the regulations, just because if you look in other industries, regulations tend to lock out the new guys. You know what I mean? They make it really expensive to get into an industry that's heavily regulated. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm. So
like, a lot of this stuff that goes through, it's going to completely demolish, like, you know, anybody who, just a good example is like, emerging artists who are remixing other people's work. That's going to be completely illegal. So for example, Diggy Diggy Hole would be an illegal song.
No, he got permission from, the Oxcast guys to do that.
Okay, well, fair enough. But even in some cases like that, it's still not allowed unless you like actually get contracts involved and stuff like that, like just verbal permission.
Forms in triplicate, so you can file it with the government and the local office of copyright control or whatever. But no, I mean, you're right. And see, the one thing I really, this is my politics shining through here a little bit, but I kind of side on the side of no regulation, just because, well, like if you look at Protect IP and PIPA, they had rules in it for, it's like, no, nobody's allowed to snoop on you except for us. And that's why I'd almost rather see no regulations written at all. And it's like, well, no, you just have to apply the laws that currently exist to the new form of technology versus writing these crazy laws that let them do whatever they want.
I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
Because right now, essentially, we do have one regulation. That is the DMCA. That's the big one I can think of. However, right now, we are essentially free to do whatever on the internet. There's no regulation saying what you can and can't do. However, these are the same people that keep trying to pass SOPA, PIPA, and all that. They're trying to enforce their own form of regulation.
Yeah.
If we could create a form of regulation that we would agree with that would prevent them from fucking us over later on with their own regulation whenever they decide to change their mind, because they will. It's the government we're talking about.
Well, I'm okay. That's a good point. It's like, well, if you let them write a regulation, what happens when the other party suddenly is in charge of the government? Because it happens every couple of years, they switch hands. So, you know, you give the government all this regulatory power over the internet, and then the people you don't like are in charge of it, you know, 4 or 8 years down the road. Oops. Which is, that's why I kind of come down on the, I'd rather say they don't have the ability to regulate the internet at all, just so you don't see stuff like that happening. But
oh, me too. But realistically, they're going to try and keep trying.
That we're seeing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're up to like, what, their fifth law trying to pass, trying to do this? I mean, that's kind of the point, is they just keep fucking coming back. And they just have a different acronym for the same damn law.
We just need to start a giant riot.
I think Occupy tried that. I don't think it worked.
We just need to... No. We're not going to riot Wall Street. We're going to go right into the RIAA and MPAA offices and just riot and wreck everything.
I prefer the concept of making them irrelevant. It's like, well, nobody's signing onto your labels. Nobody's using your distribution system. You have no power. It's like you've got everybody using licensing outside of yours. Go away. You're not relevant anymore.
That would be nice.
I've said it many times. That's one of the things I like with G15 is we've got music that has no ties to the RIAA. None of our music is licensed by them. If they come talk to us about the music we're playing, we can actually tell them to get bent. Because they're not a government agency, they're not a law enforcement agency, they are a private entity, and they do not own the genre of music. I don't care what they say.
Mm.
So, Anyways,
but they licensed the dead air space that you use.
God, the truth is, that's probably it. Yeah, we licensed silence. Yeah, good luck with that.
And they licensed rain.
Yeah, well, yeah, didn't they get that one cartoon for having the sound of wind?
Yep.
I mean, that's just... See, now that's overreach. That's where somebody needs to stop and look at what they're doing and be like, yeah, you can't patent the sound of wind. Or copyright, yeah. I guess.
That's probably where common sense is supposed to come in.
Go ahead, Analog.
I was going to say that's probably because someone's overcompensating for the small pecker they have in their pants.
Oh! Nice. What were you going to say there, Big?
I was going to ask these people, if you're listening, MPAA, RIAA execs, which you aren't, but it'd be nice if you were, just so you could hear this. What the fuck is wrong with you, and how do you people sleep at night?
I'm sure they sleep quite well. Because you got to think about it. In their mind, the internet exists to steal content from them and keep them from making money. It's not that they're not actually making money, it's just that they're not making as much as they could, so they feel it's theft. I think
you're preventing
don't...
us from making as much money as we can, so you're stealing.
See, I've never even understood the idea of copyright. I've never understood the idea of downloading an album being considered theft. Theft involves removing of someone's property. I have taken this album from you. You no longer have it. I do.
Well, in their mind, they're supposed to be the only people with the right to produce an additional copy of the work. So when you make a copy outside of their legal right to do so, you're depriving them of whatever they would have charged you to buy that copy. I guess $20 for the CD, right? So that's $20 they didn't make, but you still have your copy. Now,
but then they charge you like what, $10,000 a song?
Well,
and that's the part that's broken. Go ahead, there, Swan.
It's not so much about downloading a song; it's about uploading that song. Because, like, I know that the laws are a little bit harsher in the States, but for the pretty much everywhere you go, the laws are orders of magnitude more harsh for uploading that song versus just downloading it. Pretty much anywhere you go, because just downloading it, you're causing them the damages of you not buying that song. But the act of uploading it causes essentially unlimited damages in their eyes, because you could upload it to somebody and then they'll upload it to somebody and so on and so forth. So they you know, by their calculations, you cost them $100,000 a song.
That number actually is the statutory damages. That comes from laws that were written a long time ago when copyright infringement was large scale commercial operations. Those numbers were never intended for, you know, Billy down the street running uTorrent.
Yeah. These laws were made before it was easy for somebody to record a song at home. You know, this is when somebody would, like, you know, go buy a fucking record and make a copy of it and start selling it on their own. You know, like, that's where that was happened. Like, those laws are from when you're actually manufacturing these things.
Yeah, I mean, copying wasn't always free. I mean, it used to be you had a cost of materials. You had to set they called it the gold copy, but the original, so that you could make, as you know, the duplications. You had to have, you know, think about how expensive it was to get a CD made before the common CD burner. I mean, remember, I don't know about you guys, but remember when CD burners came out, just how excited you got over that? It's like, oh my God, I can make my own CDs.
It was amazing.
Think about how expensive CDs were to manufacture before. That there was a reason they always made them in such high quantities. It's because it's really expensive to do a run of the things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of things these laws were written for, but they've been able to adapt them and apply them to these individual file sharing cases where you essentially bankrupt somebody, because I don't know about you guys, but I don't have $100,000 laying around in the bank to pay, you know, per song.
Mm-hmm.
So...
maybe dead lady they sued had that much money.
Yeah. I think Analog does. Analog has a feel to have that much money kicking around.
The hell are you talking about?
Yeah, no.
I'm not there yet. I will be one day.
Outstanding. But I mean, but that's my point. No individual has that kind of money kicking around outside of a very, very select few. And even those, usually they don't have that money liquid. It's invested in something.
Yeah.
So, anyways,
typically those that have the money don't go downloading it either.
Oh, I don't know. They've caught some big names doing, you know, torrenting.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, most of the time, torrenting and stuff like that isn't about saving money. It's about the convenience of it. Whereas, like, you know, like, if I wanted to go, you know, get a movie from, like, I don't know, the Android store or iTunes or something like that, you got to go make an account, then put in this credit card information, worry about that information being stolen, and, like, all these hoops you got to jump through. And then after you go and pay, like, you know, $10 to see a movie, you only get 24 hours to see a digital file because it somehow is just, you know, like, oh, no. Like, you know, when you could go to a movie rental store, you'd get it for like a week. And
while you DVR it.
And it costs less than how much it costs off of like iTunes or the Android store. And on top of that, like, yeah, you can DVR it, but what if you don't have a DVR? And like, you know, that's actually illegal DVRing it because you don't have a license to copy it. So once again, you're still, you know, breaking these laws.
But you're less likely to get caught.
That's the truth. And I think that's the winning line of the argument there. So, anyways.
Just out of curiosity, how many times have people within the RIAA, the corporation itself, been caught downloading illegal content?
It's happened.
It happens all the time.
So, actually, I did have one last point in the discussion. It was coming back to the point I was trying to make about how regulations kind of tend to lock in the big wigs, and you even see the bigger companies promoting the regulations that would be really expensive because it keeps other people out of their markets. If they had done, you know, say 10 years ago, if they had passed the kind of regulations they're trying to pass today, would we all still be using like Lycos in America Online as opposed to, you know, Google and whatever else? Because you got to think, what was it, 10, 15 years ago, Google didn't actually exist?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was less than that, now that I'm thinking about it. But, you know, if they had been locked out of the market because, oh, well, you know, you have to comply with all this monitoring and, you know, you need, you know, hundreds of terabytes of hard drive space for logging and you have to provide backdoor facilities. I mean, you think about it. You know, your average website, the kind of tracking that they're asking for in these laws, there's no way you could set up a social network that to compete with Facebook with the kind of logging. Oh, yeah. Not without major, major funding just for the all the capabilities they're asking for.
Oh, yeah. It's...
Well, I mean, this when the FBI says we need backdoors so we can listen into calls and check logs, it's not like that stuff's free. I mean, somebody has to program it. You need servers to store this shit. It's not cheap to add this kind of capability. And if you've got a big player who can afford this, it's, I mean, it sucks, but they can you know, they actually have the capability to comply with it. Whereas somebody new entering the market who's got a server and, you know, an old beat up laptop and an idea, they're kind of SOL. Mm-hmm.
But to be fair, this whole NSA thing, that's been around for a long time. You know, like, that's been around longer than Google has.
Sure, and how many new telcos do you see springing up all over the place?
Good point.
I mean, you see this over and over again in businesses that are heavily regulated. You don't see new pharmaceutical research companies popping up overnight because of all the compliance and those things. I mean...
Oh, yeah. Well, also, like... It gets really difficult to compete with any large companies because, for one, those large companies are going to do their damnedest to prevent you from getting ahead. And, you know, two, you can't compete with this volume marketing where, you know, these big companies can consistently undercut you because their operating expenses are so much lower because, you know, for example, they've got all these suppliers and stuff like that bending over backwards to do business with them because they've got such a high volume, whereas these suppliers don't really care about you because you're only selling, you know, like 1/100th of their big accounts. So you're not getting as good of deals and you're not getting as good of service.
Okay, and now you take on top of that, you know, some real expensive to comply with set of government regulations, and it's just one more thing to make it that much harder for a new competitor to enter the market.
Yeah.
So, anyways, let's move on to current events here. I think we've made our points.
One thing I do want to say, though, I just wanted to add, pretty much every company that I work for is one of these smaller companies, you know, under 200 employees. So, you know, like, not really tiny, but, you know, smaller than any of the, like, large corporations or anything. And every single time they've managed to stay competitive by making high-quality products in a market where it's a bunch of, like, really cheap, low-quality stuff. So like, you know, there's all these, you know, big brands and stuff like that where you can get these products, but, you don't get the level of service and you don't actually get the build quality and usability out of, your stuff. Because a lot of the time these bigger companies, they don't have the incentive to be really innovative because they've already got like the dominant market share and, you know, they're making tons of money. Why do they have to worry too much? Whereas like these smaller companies, like, yeah, they do have to work harder, but they can get some very loyal customers just by, like, being good quality.
Well, and that's kind of the point I'm making. I'd hate to see it, you know, lock guys like that out of an industry because there's a minimal, you know, cost getting in the game of, you know, $100,000 just to even get in the game because of a compliance thing. You know what I mean? That's the only point I was trying to make on that.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyways, this is fun. This is from PC World. Oracle has known since April about the existence of the two unpatched Java 7 vulnerabilities that are currently being exploited in malware attacks, according to Adam Godwick, the, did I say that right? Godwick? G-O-W-D-I-A-K. I'm not sure how to say that. I'm not trying to be insulting to the dude. The founder and CEO of Polish security firm, Security Explorations. Security Explorations reported 19 Java 7 security issues to Oracle on April 2nd. Those issues included the 2.0-day unpatched, that's not true, they have been patched, vulnerabilities that attackers are exploiting to infect computers with malware, Godwick said on email, or Wednesday via email. The company continued to report Java 7 vulnerabilities to Oracle in the following months, until the total number reached 29, we demonstrated 16 full Java SE7 sandbox compromises with the use of our bugs, Godwick said. According to the security researchers from the security firm Immunity, the Java exploit published online earlier this week and integrated into the Black Hole Attack Rootkit or toolkit makes use of two Java vulnerabilities, not one, as it was previously believed. The first bug was used to get a reference to sun.awt.suntoolkit class that is restricted to applets, where the second bug invokes the get field public static method on suntoolkit using reflection with a trusted immediate caller bypassing a security check. So essentially that means they break out of the Java sandbox and they can run native code on the machine. While both these vulnerabilities, one in the class finder class and one in the method finder class, were found in reported by Security Explorations in April, the proof-of-concept exploits supplied by the company to Oracle combined with other bugs, not together, Godwick said. Now, so what this means is that the Java bug that made news this week, Oracle's known about it since April, and they've just, you know, they're just now getting around to fixing it. They actually released the patch today. You know, Java 1.7.07 has been released, and I've got a link in the show notes to where you can go pull it down. If you're running 1.7, and we know you are because you play Minecraft, go get that. Because if you're not, the vulnerability lets websites do drive-by downloads, essentially. Now, I'm not going to fault them too much for how long they've known about this, because sometimes these things take time to fix and get a patch out and test and go through, you know, QoS and all that good stuff. But they have known about it since April. I kind of feel like, well, yes, it takes time, and a few months is not out of the question for fixing this stuff. If it's something like this that's going to be exploited in the wild, they really need to get on the ball.
Do you think Oracle really cares?
No. No, that's why they bought Sun, is just to eliminate competition. It's just like we were talking about earlier. They don't have a lot of competition in their space right now, so they don't care. I mean, how many companies are so reliant on Java that it's like, if Oracle just said tomorrow, it's like, yep, we're going to start up charging $1,000 per license to run Java on a machine, these companies would shell out the money because they don't have another choice. All of their business processes are in little custom programs in Java. And hell, how many college computer science courses are taught in Java?
That really makes me mad. Computer science should be taught in C or assembly. Java is nowhere near computer science level, in my opinion.
Well, Java is a good for teaching object-oriented. I would rather see them use open languages, you know, C++ and C, rather than Java. But it's the whole Microsoft Office versus word processing argument. They don't really teach, you know, word processing. They don't really teach operating systems. They teach Microsoft Office and Windows. So, you know, the education industry is an industry, so I don't know. So nobody else wants to comment on the Oracle bug, because I spent all day dealing with the damn thing.
I would, but I'm eating cake.
That is a very good argument.
You bastard.
I want cake. Everybody, to Big's house.
Nice. Mm. Okay. I don't think I hit the right button. Doesn't matter. Anyways, next story up. This one's actually from the ACLU. And this is really funny for me to be reading an ACLU post, because I normally don't pay them very much attention. But anyways, excuse me. They've got an interesting take on TPP here, which I thought was worth bringing up. So, as we've seen in the failed attempts of SOPA and PIPA, the floundering anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, intellectual property laws are often poorly constructed, hastily proposed, and ultimately both ineffective and potentially abusive. Thank you, Lord of the Obvious. Now that the latest threat to free speech in the guise of IP reform is a multilateral trade agreement currently being negotiated in secret by the Office of the United States Trade Representatives, that agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, would reportedly include dramatic changes to intellectual property laws, changes that could potentially permit the patenting of plants, animals, and medical procedures.
And while seriously?
That's what ACLU is saying. And while some of the proposed changes run contrary to enacted federal law, the USTR is not only pushing for TPP, is doing its best to avoid congressional oversight. For instance, they recently rebuffed a request from the staff director on the Senate Finance Committee's International Trade Subcommittee to review the documents pertaining. So they told the senator to get bent when they were asking to look at what they're negotiating here. Aside from the cloak and dagger nature of the negotiation, some of the most troubling aspects of TPP are significant expansion of patent protections. While we tend to hear a lot about how IP regulations affect online content, leaked versions of TPP would require the signatory countries to permit the patenting of plants and animals, as well as the diagnostic, therapeutic, and surgical methods of treatment on humans or animals, all without explicit limits on enforcement. Current U.S. law forbids the enforcement of surgical patents against medical practitioners for good reason. We don't want doctors wondering if they're risking a patent infringement suit every time they try a new surgical technique. So, yeah, they're going to let them patent surgical techniques and plants and animals.
What the hell?
Yeah, that's...
This is not the purpose of a patent.
No, it's not, but it's the system's been perverted. It's corrupt as hell at this point, and now they're just using it as a way to do a money grab. It's like, oh nope, yeah, you cut on that guy in a way that we patented, you know, whenever, never minding the fact that people have been doing surgery that way since 1800s. Too bad, we patented it, so you owe us $1 million.
Quick question, since they can patent animals, can I patent the animal known as politicians?
You have to look under scum, I think. I'm not sure if that's been grabbed yet or not.
Or invertebrates.
Well, scum is just a higher category that politicians fall under.
Nice. So here's what I wonder. With the rise of consumer EEG machines, I mean, you can get them for $100 now. How long until they start patenting certain brain patterns?
Oh, we've actually got a story for that later in the show. Don't worry about it.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Freaking great.
So, yeah, they're not quite patenting your brain patterns just yet, but you know they're thinking it. And, well, hell, why not? This is right after the old After Now radio play, where they were just patenting everything, like up to the language.
They'll patent your mind, brain, body, and soul.
and time.
Well, I mean, think about it. If it gets to the point where you can patent, you know, we've patented this genome. It's like, well, you were born with our patented genome, so you owe us money for existing. It's like, no, I was actually born this way like 10 years before you patented it. Doesn't that count as prior art? Nope, doesn't count. You owe us money. I mean, patent trolling is already a problem, and they're one. Seriously, you can go in and look at the record right now and see what a big problem patent trolling is. You've got software developers throwing up their hands and saying, we can't work like this anymore. We can't do anything because everything's patented.
Hey, look at how Apple, this whole big lawsuit that just happened between Samsung and Apple. And like, yeah, sure, Samsung did go out and look at the iPad. They were like, hey, this is a good idea. We should do this too. Thing is, all of these patents, all were things that existed long before Apple made any even a phone.
Yeah, Nokia had patented the whole flip phone idea.
Oh yeah, it's ridiculous, and it completely destroys innovation.
Well, they were getting down to with the app. I didn't even want to talk about the Apple Samsung thing because it kind of ticks me off. Because they were getting down to the color of the telephone icon and the curve of the bezel. It's like you can patent a fucking curve now.
Yeah, last week I thought that was ridiculous, but after hearing people can patent plants and animals, that's nothing. That's just par for the course.
So what? I'm going to go out and patent a fucking circle and watch how much money I make. I mean, my God.
No, you patent a sphere, and then you charge the whole planet for copyright in your...
Yeah, I mean, this is retarded, is what it is.
I've got an idea. We're going to patent a golden rectangle with slightly curved edges. Oh, Apple will owe us so much money.
They'll claim they have it first.
Well, that's not a problem. I mean, they didn't review the patents for Samsung. Which is another thing. It's kind of funny that they sued Samsung, even though they buy most of their parts for the iPad from Samsung.
If you can't innovate, litigate,
like,
I guess.
It's like 25%.
Yeah, something like that.
But, it's business as usual.
It's just
Samsung's going to keep selling to them, and they're going to keep buying because it's business.
Samsung and Foxconn should just sever all ties with Apple. Let them just... Oh, man, that'd
be
great.
Hilarious, wouldn't it? For, like, just a month. But, you know, Apple makes a lot of money, so... I don't know. Anyways, next story here. This one's fun. This is from The Register. Security researchers have discovered a potential dangerous... Linux and Mac OS X cross-platform Trojan. Once installed on a compromised machine, WireNet 1 opens a backdoor to... Who names these things? I mean, really? WireNet 1? Anyways. Opens a backdoor to a remote command server and logs key presses to capture passwords and so any other, you know, botnet backdoor, right? The program also grabs passwords submitted to Opera, Firefox, Chrome, and Chromium web browsers, and credentials stored by applications including email client Thunderbird, WebSuite, SeaMonkey, and chat app Pigeon. The malware then attempts to upload the gathered data to a server hosted in the Netherlands. The software nasty was intercepted by Russian antivirus firm Dr. Web and the company that carried out much of the analysis of the infamous flashback Trojan. Dr. Webb describes WireOne as the first Linux OS X cross-platform password-stealing Trojan. Are they sure it's not just written in Java? Since Java runs on all of them? So, anyways, multi-platform virus strains that infect Windows, Mac OS X, and Linux machines are extremely rare, but not unprecedented. One example includes a recent crisis superworm, creating a strain of malware that infects OS X and Linux machines, but not Windows boxes. Seems frankly weird, given the sizes of each operating system's user base. Unless the virus has been designed for some kind of closely targeted attack on an organization that uses a mix of two Unix flavors. Analysis work on WireNet 1 is ongoing for now, and it's unclear how the Trojan was designed to spread. Once executed, it copies itself into the user's home directory and then uses AES to encrypt its communications with a server over the internet. I almost wonder if it was written for OS X and it just kind of happens to work on Linux since they're both POSIX compliant operating systems.
Fairly possible.
Or maybe the other way around. Maybe it was written for Linux and it happens to work on OS X.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know, I gotta say, I do miss the days of the CDC and their awesome naming schemes for viruses. You got Back Orifice, you've got the plug impact for Back Orifice called Butt Plug. Oh man, they had some awesome naming schemes.
They did.
They've gotten so many now. Wire one. They've gotten so many virus names now, they're having trouble coming up with sensationalism for, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so I just wanted to point out that, yeah, viruses for OS X and Linux are starting to show up and starting to be more common. So just, you know what? When you're out there on the internet, just don't click shit. I mean, just don't click on random shit. You'll be fine.
So if it says I have a virus and I should scan, I shouldn't click on that?
Well, my favorite is when you're on a Linux machine and you get the Internet Explorer, you know, pop-up. Saying, you know, your system has problems on C:D, and we're gonna run this scan. It's like, yeah, I'm on Linux Mint, jackass. It doesn't look like that.
Good luck.
So, yeah, it's even funnier when people on Mac send me screenshots of the Windows 98, you know, looking, fake antiviruses trying to run on their systems. That's always great.
One time, I had this really awesome virus I had to take care of. It did a fake blue screen.
Nice. And
at the very bottom, it had a hypertext link to where you can download their free cleaner. And then it did a reboot, again, with a hypertext link to their software.
I had a friend of mine awesome. Who got one of the variants on Antivirus 360 on his laptop. And this was a couple years ago. And it replaced his wallpaper with an active desktop link. Like, the whole thing was one giant link. Like, it didn't matter where you clicked on the desktop. If it wasn't the start button or an icon, it was opening a web page and going to their web form where you can give them $99.99 for their cleaning tool.
Oh, God, that's great.
It replaced every icon on their desktop, or the target of every link on their desktop, with the web shortcut to where you can go to their web page and pay $99.99 for the cleanup tool. It replaced text on web pages as you opened them with "this web page recommends you go here and pay us $99.99 for the cleanup tool." I mean, it was just everywhere. I think the idea was just to annoy you into giving them your credit card number so it would go away.
That's a brilliant strategy, actually.
So, but yeah, I mean, like, it didn't matter what you clicked on that machine. It was taking you to their website and asking you for the, $100. So... we got it cleaned up. It involved slaving the drive in another machine and, a lot of Windex. But, anyways. Yeah, okay. But, that was Xander's machine. Analog, you remember Xander, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was his laptop. And I'm actually not kidding about the Windex because he started smacking the screen. So, anyways, we were talking about them breeding your brain waves. This is from Wired. Don't you dare even think about your banking account password when you slap on those fancy new brainwave headsets. Or at least that seems to be the lesson of a new study, which found that sensitive personal information, such as PIN numbers and credit card data, can be gleaned from brainwave data of users wearing popular consumer-grade EEG headsets. A team of security researchers from Oxford, UC Berkeley, and the University of Geneva have said they were able to deduce the digits of PIN numbers, birth months, areas of residence, and other personal information by presenting 30 headset-wearing subjects with images of ATM machines, debit cards, maps, people, and random numbers in a series of experiments. The paper, titled On the Feasibility of Sidechain Attacks with Brain-Computer Interfaces, represents the first major attempt to uncover potential security risks in the use of headsets. The correct answer was found in the first guess by 20% of the cases for the experiment with the PIN and the debit cards. And in the PIN, the debit cards, people, and the ATM machines, wrote the researchers. The location was exactly guessed for 30% of the users, month of birth for almost 60%, and bank based on the ATM machines for almost 30%. To detect the first digit of the PIN, researchers presented the subjects with the numbers 0 to 9, flashing on the screen in random order, one by one. Each number was repeated 16 times over a duration of 90 seconds. These subject brain waves were monitored for telltale peaks that would rat them out. Now, I cut a lot out of this article because as I was reading it, I started to think it was more they were advertising the EEGs rather than talking about this research. But I wanted to talk about the research with you guys because I think it's kind of interesting. Because they went on to really go into detail about these EEGs, and I think they were trying to make the point of, look how sensitive they are. You can spend $200 on this EEG, and it can read your PIN number from your brain. And, you know, they were going on and on and on.
Actually, yeah. The Epoch's more like $399. I almost got that one.
Well, I cut up the article because I felt like they were advertising the EEGs more than they were talking about the research. And if you look at the percentage rates of 20 and 30%, you could almost, you know, statistically randomly get some of those percentages. So,
well, and you know, like, these are conditions that would never happen in the real world. Mm. You know, like,
I did cut it out of the article, but they did talk about how they could get real world situations. A lot of these EEGs have app stores, and they were talking about putting up malicious apps where it's like, oh, well, you have to train the app. So as part of the training process, it starts, you know, showing you numbers, showing you an ATM machine, stuff like that.
Okay.
So they did go into how the attack could work a little bit, but I ended up cutting it out of the article because, like I said, I wasn't sure how much of it was advertisement.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, so it's kind of a cyberpunk idea. It's like, you know, you buy this EKG to play your games, or I don't know what else you would do with this thing. I mean, I guess if you're, you know, missing an arm, it could replace a mouse. That'd be kind of cool, actually.
Well, actually, I saw a video today on something very similar as far as controlling other objects. They were doing a quadcopter via an EKG or via the machine.
EEG.
Yeah, EEG. EKG. We were talking about EKG earlier. Anyways, the EEG machine. So, and actually, in the video, they showed one person controlling it with the EEG machine and another person controlling another one via an actual remote by hand, and where they had a battle against each other, and the EEG machine won.
Well, yeah, because once you're trained, you'd probably get your reaction time really low.
Yeah.
So.
That's kind of the reason why I got this one.
Nice. So how was that one work you have there, Big?
It works all right. I got the little bit cheaper end one, Mindwave. I don't know if I should say the brand name.
No, but, you're fine. I just, the article got really blatant. That's why I cut it up.
It's pretty nice. It's got a Bluetooth connection. Like you said, it's got an app store. I can run it on anything. I've got it. I did have it hooked up to my robot arm for a while via Bluetooth. And I talked to the computer, and the serial data went over to the Arduino, and it started moving. Problem was, I couldn't figure out a good way to differentiate the different axi of the arm. With the brainwave.
Oh, I got you. So it worked, but it was kind of erratic.
How would I move the elbow and the shoulder? Yeah.
Yeah. So. Which is kind of going to be a problem in the first.
It only had one sensor on it. The one from this article, the Emotive, has like 13. So it might have been a better choice for such a project.
Yeah. Right, next story up. Keeping on that nice cyberpunk theme. This one's from Extreme Tech. Bioengineers at Harvard University have created the first example of cyborg tissues. Neurons, heart cells, muscle, and blood vessels are interwoven with nanowires and transistors. These cyborg tissues are half-living cells, half-electronics. As far as the cells are concerned, they're just normal cells that behave normally. But the electronic side actually act as a sensor network, allowing a computer to interface directly with the cells. In the case of a cyborg heart tissue, the researchers have already used the embedded nanowires to measure the contractions, or the heart rate, of the cells. To create cyborg flesh, you start with a three-dimensional scaffold that encourages cells to grow around them. These scaffolds are generally made out of collagen, which makes up the connective tissue in almost every animal. The Harvard engineers basically took normal collagen, wove nanowires and transistors into the matrix to create the nanoelectric scaffolding, nano-ES. The neurons, heart cells, muscle, and blood vessels were then grown as normal, creating cyborg tissue with a built-in sensor network. So far, the Harvard team has mostly grown rat tissues, but they also succeeded in growing a 1.5-centimeter cyborg human blood vessel. They've also used the nanoelectric scaffolds to read data from the cells. But according to the lead researcher, Charles Libler, The next step is to find a way of talking to the individual cells. To wire up tissue and communicate with it is in the same way a biological system does. Suffice to say, if you can use digital computer to read and write data to your body's cells, there are some awesome applications. If you need a quick jolt of adrenaline, you'd simply tap a button on your smartphone. Okay, that's a bad idea. Which is directly connected to your sympathetic nervous system. You could augment your existing physiology with patches. A patch of nanoelectric heart cells, for example, that integrates with your heart and reports back if you experience any problem. You get a problem light for your heart. When we eventually put nanobots. Okay, they go on here. Some of their examples are kind of dumb. Realistically, we're a long way from applications. In the short term, these cyborg tissues could be used to create very accurate organs on a chip. Lab-grown human organs that are encased within computer chips and then used to test drugs or substance toxicity without harming a single bunny or bombo. Okay, the idea of organs on a chip for drug testing, that's kind of cool. Just being able to read cells, think about the nice Ghost in the Shell applications of somebody who's lost a limb. You take one of these, you know, nanoelectric patches and slap it on the end of their nervous system, like on the stump, and then put the robot arm attached to that, and then you're golden, right? I mean, who cares that it can't write back? You can read.
Heck, and also, you can cover the robotic arm with real flesh that connects to the hardware in the arm.
Yeah, so, I mean, this stuff's really in the early stages, and the whole idea of, we're going to hook it up to your smartphone, yeah, that's dumb.
Yeah.
No, it's not. Because
closed.
Wait till you get malware on your phone and your phone gives you a heart attack so that they can collect your life insurance after they steal your identity.
I know.
They have ads that stimulate
the pleasure center of your brain.
Yeah, I was going to say the most downloaded smartphone app in the next 100 years will be the orgasm button.
Well, you know, there's that fleshlight you hook up on an iPad that's fairly close to that already, right? So,
but that involves work. I can just push a button and get instant gratification. Oh, yeah, you know I will.
And Big Walk starts walking around in a diaper. Okay.
Well, the thing is, you know, something like that comes out, it'll be the end of humanity. No, I'm not even joking. You know, just look at all of the, how easy it is to get addicted to stuff. And if an app comes out that is this is basically going to be the most addictive thing because it's going to target like the best pleasure centers of your brain. So it's going to feel better than anything. And it'll be legal. So, you know, there's going to be people who will just sit and push that button all day. And, if they've done experiments and stuff like that, they'll take rats and hook up a wire to the pleasure center in their brain and give them a button and give them food. And they will sit there and push that button till they're dead. Just saying.
Again, Suave bringing down the really cool cyberpunk stories here. So, thanks, Suave.
Well, no, you know, it's not going to kill everybody, but it'll be a pandemic.
It'll be the Darwin button.
There you go.
Yeah.
What's it do? It filters out the people who would have sat at home masturbating all day long. Okay.
I guess I'm dead then.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, it'll be like the true to life.
So, all right, last story I got here. RU sent me this. It's from the BBC. And this is fun just because it shows that, well, we're starting to see cyber attacks. God, I hate phrasing it like that. From company to company or group to company. About 30,000 workstation computers are back online at Saudi Aramco after a virus hit the world's largest oil producer. The remote access was still restricted as a precaution, the group said. Oil production was not affected by the virus, which struck on the 15th of August, Saudi Aramco added. The company took its website offline after the attack and now carries a message on its front page apologizing for any inconvenience. We have isolated all of our electronic systems from outside access as an early precautionary measure that was taken following a sudden disruption which affected some sectors of our network, the message reads. Most of the damage has now been repaired, it added. Good lord, this thing's badly written. A group named the Cutting Sword of Justice has claimed, at least they got a good name, has claimed responsibility for the attack in an online forum. It blamed the Saudi government for crimes and atrocities in several countries and said that the state-run oil firm was hit because it was the key source of income for the government. This was not the first, nor will it be the last, illegal attempt to intrude on our systems, said Khalid Al-Fahi, president and chief executive of Saudi Aramco. Last week, a virus called Shamoon, S-H-A-M-O-O-N, so yeah, Shamoon, which targeted companies in the energy industry was reported by security experts. Saudi Aramco has not said whether or not this was the malware involved. So, yeah, you've got groups here trying to use viruses as political statements.
One thing that I wonder, why are such mission-critical computer systems hooked
on
up
the
to
internet?
Yes. Exactly. And a power plant of all things, I can understand if they've got a local intranet, but that should not be connected to the internet at all.
Yeah, that's, well, what if somebody wants to check their Facebook? It's like, well, if you really want the NSA to see what, you know, you're doing. Basic security design, people. It's like, if it's mission critical, air gap it. It's not that hard.
Well, not even just basic security. Common sense, at least, is all I'm asking for.
Common sense is neither common nor a sense, unfortunately.
You know, that's the thing, hey. It really just comes down to education. Because all of the people who are instituting the security policies don't really understand what they're making these policies for.
That's true.
And that's really where all of these problems are originating. Really, it's just going to... And, you know, like, a guy could say, oh, yeah, we'll just wait till, you know, the younger generation gets old enough to figure this stuff out. But they're not picking up on computers like we all thought that they would. You know, because I remember, like, we were all thinking, like, okay, well, you know, these kids who start using computers when they're two, they're just going to be these crazy computer whizzes. All they do is sit around and fucking play around on Facebook all day. You know, yeah. Like,
It's people who started messing around with computers when, you know, Windows wasn't out there, the ones that are the computer whizzes. Because, well, it's like, I started on Commodore 64 when you actually had to program the damn thing to get anything out of it. And, you know, well, and that's debatable. Okay, I didn't have a lot of software, so I had to program it to get anything out of it. But, you know, a lot of times now people are like who started out on Windows, they don't even know what it's doing. They think it's just a magic box that lets them look at Facebook.
Yeah.
I think more people should be exposed to microcomputers and the 1980s build it, do it yourself mentality.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, like another thing is, that's one thing that schools are really lagging behind on is teaching people about computers. Because, yeah, sure, they teach you how to use a word processor. And they might teach you, like, BASIC or something like that for, you know, learn how to say hello world and shit. But, like, nothing really useful. And, you know, like, they don't teach you about networking. They don't teach you how to, like, keep your computer safe when you're browsing the internet. It doesn't teach you any, like, good security policies aside from, oh, well, you should change your password every week that nobody ever follows anyways. And, you know, like, it doesn't teach kids the things that they need to know about computer systems and keeping themselves safe.
Yeah. All right, well, now to wrap up.
Me love you long time.
All right, this one is fun. This is just going to do a quick little review of a tool. And a semi-review of a tool, really. I didn't get to play with it that much. It's from Mavutina Security, and it's NetSparker. If it's the NetSparker has actually updated their community edition. And the copy from their page reads, "We announced NetSparker Community Edition in early 2010. The security community loved it, however, we weren't sure about supporting it as we couldn't figure out how the consequences in the long term. You know, giving that much of NetSparker for free, risky business. We therefore haven't updated it as frequently as NetSparker Professional or Standard. From the time we released NetSparker CE 17213 till today, 6 significant updates were provided for commercial versions, but not for the community edition." So they go on and talk about it here. I'm not going to read the rest of it. They've updated their community edition, which is a free version of their website scanner. If you know what Nessus is, think Nessus for websites. And they don't even have a give us your email, make an account page. It's free. You just go download it. And it's a nice little website scanner. It looks for security, it looks for code injection, it looks for common problems on your website, places where you can find error messages, and all kinds of good little stuff, you know, data exposure. And anyways, so yeah, I pulled it down to play with it. I actually ran it against Galaxy 15, and about 30% in on the scan, RIDS triggered and just killed it. But that's actually good, because that's what you'd want from the IDS. Oh, and it filled up my email box with alerts. But anyway, so it did find actually some stuff on the G15, which I've cleaned up. But it's mostly related to old themes that were kicking around on the server. It wasn't anything that was a real big problem. But, you know, it's a nice, easy tool. You point it at a website and it scans it, and then you get a report. It tries to classify things based on severity, and you can go in and look at what response it got. Now, they've got a claim on their website that they claim they have no false positives. And anybody who's done anything with scanning software knows what bullshit that is. So I wouldn't trust this thing to find everything. This is an easy way to find low-hanging fruit and get a quick scan of a website, you know, code injection, the obvious stuff, you know what I mean? It just saves you time digging through, you know, say a 100-page website looking for problems. And anyways, since they claim no false positives, I would be worried that they're coming down on the side of something's not a problem, even though it might be, you know, because the scanner's not sure and they don't want to claim it as a false positive. So anyways, if you've got a website that you're running and you're wanting to make sure doesn't have any really easy to attack problems in it, you know, SQL injection, maybe you got a forum, you know, something like that, you can just pull this down and run it against it and get a lot of the really dumb scripting attacks and try to just to see if you're vulnerable to them. And it's a good way to get started on trying to fix that stuff up. You know, it's probably not the best tool out there, but it's a start. And it's free. So I don't know, did anybody
can't beat free.
No.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking I should probably run that on the IHN page.
Yeah. It's you know, it'll figure out its WordPress fairly quickly and then go through how to attack it. So but I mean, go ahead there.
I was just gonna ask, I wonder how many web designers actually use something like this to make sure that they are secure.
How successful has Anonymous been? I would say approximately none. Seriously, I doubt anybody runs stuff like this on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though, no, this thing's not going to find everything. If you get a skilled attacker or skilled penetration tester coming after your site, they're probably going to find something this tool misses. But this is going to get the basic stuff, the script kiddie stuff. I mean, right. You know, you want to keep Anonymous from dumping out your database easily. You know, at least make them work for it, right? If they're going to get your data, at least make them put in a little bit of effort, right?
Makes sense.
So, anyways, just to kind of close out the show here, of course, promos. Listen to the stream. We're constantly working on it. Well, I say that. We're always looking for new music to add, and I'd actually like to get some new DJs in on the station. We've been working on that. We've got the back end to support DJs now. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. In Our 7 on Mondays, I believe. And as always, keep up on the Galaxy 15 radio site and the Twitter handles. Use the feedback form and the shout box. So unless anybody else has anything else to add, I'm going to hit the play button on this music.
Fuck the MPAA. Fuck the RIAA.